Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Aid Evolved, and I'm your host, Rowena Luke. This season, we're speaking with donors and investors who are driving new ways to improve lives in Africa. Today, I am so excited to welcome John Fairhurst to the show. John is the head of private sector engagement at the Global Fund. For those of you in the public health space, I think the Global Fund needs no introduction. But for those of you dialing in from elsewhere, let me just add that the Global Fund, in its 20 years of existence, has channeled something like $55 billion. I think I got that right. $55 billion to the fight against HIV, TB, and malaria around the world. So it is an institution. And John is responsible for building the connections between that institution and the private sector. In the conversation today, we're going to talk about John's work with big tech, household names like Google and Microsoft, and also how the Global Fund works with and elevates emerging technologies and new startups. We'll also talk about the relationships that just don't work out, the partnerships that don't make sense. Bonus, you get to hear about how John got schooled by a woman in rural Afghanistan and what that taught him about working in global development. Be sure to stick around for the end when John shares his one piece of advice to donors supporting innovations from the private sector. If you like what you hear on the show today, be sure to connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe to the show so that you don't miss an episode. One last thing. We'll be taking time in a future episode to air your questions and comments. So send a recording or an email to podcast@aidevolve.com and hear yourself on this show. Now, let's get started by learning a little bit more about John Fairhurst. John started his career in pharma and finance. He joined Oxfam, where he oversaw their work in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Eritrea, and Afghanistan. That's kind of intense. He helped establish the portfolio of one of the largest private foundations in international development, the Children's Investment Fund, and was COO at the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. Before joining the Global Fund, he served as an executive director at UBS Optimus Foundation. I asked John to share with us something that people who work with him might not know, something about the people who have influenced his work.
One of the most sort of important experiences, which links to something that people might not know, is that my favorite country in the world is Afghanistan.
I did not know that.
It's a country I worked for a couple of years, around 2001, 2002. And it's just an incredible country that has been, you know, so devastated by conflict, by poverty, by natural disaster, by earthquakes and droughts, but yet the people there are just the most amazingly resilient and welcoming and warm communities that really do bring you into their lives as a sort of visitor. And it always felt so, I guess, juxtaposed with the image that a country like Afghanistan has in what we often see and hear about the country. And so it's really settled, I guess, in my heart around the things that, you know, the things that motivate me to do the kind of work that I do, because those countries, the stories we see and the representation we get misses the fact that people who live in those countries are just the most incredible people to manage their lives and deliver their passion.
Was there a particular moment or a person or interaction while you were working there that sticks in your mind when you remember those years?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There is one. I traveled one day. I was there and the first time that the Taliban were in charge of the country, and obviously the current context is particularly devastating to see. We drove for nearly 3 days to find a place, and then we actually went on horseback for another 2 days to get to a series of communities.
So you're a horseback rider?
No, I wasn't. But after 2 days, I was a lot better. And we met this woman there who said to me that I must think she's stupid.
Huh.
Having traveled, you know, as a Westerner out into the communities. And so we had this whole conversation around that was so far from the truth, because the ability to live and to thrive. And the main thing was to really have this passion around children's education, and particularly girls' education, because as we all know, that's a huge challenge in Afghanistan then and again now. You know, a horrible context to be in. And so her drive and support was so far from this idea, I felt actually incompetent in her presence and incapable of really, you know, really to show that kind of passion and commitment.
I love the audacity of that woman. You must think I'm stupid, John. I love that she called you out.
But again, it goes to this sort of, you know, the sense of the perspectives that we all have of each other. And I think really challenged my perspective around how you can bring support to people, but they have to be at the center of defining how they want to live their lives and how they use that support.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it's private sector or support or anything else, it's not the image I think that many people have of the people who are poor and marginalized.
Absolutely. Thank you for that story, John. Next, we wanted to dive more into the work that you do, establishing partnerships between basically everybody. You manage a million different partnerships, and we're only going to touch on a specific part of it, and I'm just going to acknowledge that. But I was hoping we could get started talking about big tech, which is a topic that's on people's minds a lot. I know the Global Fund has worked with some of the biggest, still works with some of the biggest names in tech, Microsoft, Google, etc. Can you provide some color to the picture of how those partnerships come together? Like, how do you create and manage those things? What are some of the benefits and the risks that you're constantly navigating in those partnerships?
In a way, it links a little bit to that story, in the sense that our view is that we need to connect the sort of resources between those different kinds of contexts. And of course, big tech has, you know, these incredible resources. They have incredible intellectual capacity. They have an amazing toolkit to do all sorts of things that make business successful, make health in high-income countries more successful, whether you're talking about Google or Microsoft or Salesforce or whoever.
You need to get Microsoft to give you OpenAI.
Well, and it's a great example of, you know, the what often happens is those technologies get progressed and evolved in very commercial settings for all sorts of reasons, which are positive. But they're not deployed in the same way in places that don't have an effective business model for people like the woman I met in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so our role is to try and bring that connection, because it's hugely powerful to have Google's information processing capabilities and AI as well, as you say. You know, what we really want to do is make sure that this is needs-based. So it's not about finding technology for the sake of it, but saying what are the critical problems that these technologies or capacities can solve. And so what we're doing is, in essence, bringing the connection between these problem statements. For example, one of the critical problem statements in the world, which is very relevant, is the ability to find people who have TB. Because not everybody knows it's a respiratory disease like COVID, not always diagnosed effectively. There's 4 million people in the world who never get diagnosed, never get found. And if you can use some of these information analytics to target where you're testing, where you're searching for people, then you can become much more efficient and effective at finding the hotspots, at supporting patients, and at cutting the disease off, stopping those people giving it to other people.
Yeah.
And so those examples, AI, for example, is being used in X-ray screening. So that rather than having to have a highly qualified doctor to screen an X-ray and say that person has TB, you can actually now use AI to look at the images and identify the fact that these people, you know, are infected, and then make sure they transition to treatment. And so bringing those technologies to these sort of needs-based issues is really powerful. On the risk side, we have a really detailed sort of due diligence process, which allows us to look at companies and understand the kind of risks that they have. And you know, the truth is all organizations have risks associated with themselves. And that's really important to us, that we make sure we build that risk analysis into how we define the project. So we make sure there's no conflict of interests. You know, we're not working on things that are purely business related. We make sure that we're clear in the countries where there may be challenges for technology companies to work on either side. So that's a really important part of what we do. But the critical piece is we start from, you know, how can we take a challenge that we see in our world, finding TB cases or screening X-rays, and then bring the, you know, these very advanced technologies to be deployed to solve it, because that gets a really positive outcome for everybody, you know, for the people with TB, but also for the technology companies to know that they've contributed.
Absolutely. There's a great document I'll link in the show notes from the Global Fund just describing your policy approach and explicitly calling out the risks. You know, these are the risks and this is how we're going to tackle them. And I really like that you're putting it front and center. You're making it clear you've thought about them and you've proceeded with the relationships that are going to address those risks. Next question for you, John, is about the little guys, the startups. I'm sure you must be inundated all the time by these smart young entrepreneurs who want to get the heft of the Global Fund behind them. What guidance do you give all those entrepreneurs? Are there any success stories you can point to about how Global Fund has directly or indirectly supported a startup to scale?
Yeah, it's hugely important. I think if you look at our context, you know, whether it's global health or nutrition or education, what's really clear, I think, is that we need to drive the effectiveness of how we spend money. You know, the money is never, even more in our current world, a sort of bottomless pit, unfortunately, or a magic money tree.
Yeah.
So this whole innovation space in terms of driving, you know, more effectiveness of the solutions we have is more important than ever, I think. And I think a lot of that innovation, to your point, comes from entrepreneurs. It comes from people starting new ideas. So it's really, really important for us to look at. The critical thing, and we've seen this in a number of the partnerships that we work on, is it is like in business, those entrepreneurs having a sort of pathway to scale and really understanding how their technology would become a scaled solution. Because I think it's often hard to scale an idea if it wasn't designed with scale in mind. And that's, I think, where a lot of innovation sort of struggles. It's fantastic. It's really effective, but it's too expensive, or it needs a cold chain that you can't provide in the kind of context that we're working in. So just understanding, you know, the real context, I think, is so important. I mean, it's like any business. If you know your customer, if you know your market, and understand that as you build your innovation, you're much more likely to be successful.
Yeah, what I like about the cold chain example that you threw out there is that it sort of points to the fact that you, in the role that you have, you're looking at the big picture. You know, how do we actually tackle malaria and TB? There's lots of innovations out there. You know, maybe you're building a better diagnostic or a better, you know, truck or something like that. But if it's not addressing the whole picture that's actually going to move the outcomes forward, then the Global Fund doesn't really have a role to play there, right? Like Global Fund, you don't exist in order to place bets. You exist to fight HIV, TB, and malaria.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that we've been doing a lot of with big tech and smaller sort of startups is trying to make sure that we're designing the solutions in a sort of scaling environment. So this whole history of, look, we develop an idea and then we sort of throw it over the fence to the big guys and they scale it. Mm. It's very inefficient because we throw probably 99% of the things back over the fence and say it doesn't work.
Try again.
Whereas if you actually have a sort of, if you like, a door in the fence where we're actually, you know, working together to think about, okay, if we scaled this diagnostic, if we scaled this new piece of technology, artificial intelligence in TB screening, how would we design it in the first place so that it can be scalable? So it's in a way, it's that translational conversation of going from sort of an innovation to something bigger. This is what they term in any sector, the sort of valley of death. Yeah, this is where, in venture capital, where organizations fall and never climb out.
The valley of death. For those of you outside venture capital, let me explain. When you make a new invention, at the very beginning, you get by on your savings or a check from your mom, maybe sleeping on a friend's couch. Much later, in the life of an invention, hopefully it's generating revenue of some kind. Hopefully it's paying for itself and you're off to the races, you're scaling. But there's that long, dark slog in between those two spaces, the years that you spend working on building and iterating and testing on something and basically losing money after you've spent all your family savings and before the venture capitalists are interested in you. That place, that's the valley of death. And that's where 9 out of 10 startups fail. John speaks to the role of the global fund in that middle area before venture capitalists and other institutional investors are ready to come in, helping new inventions find that path to scale.
That conversation in the middle, which is where the global fund, the role I play, I think is really focused. It's so central to the success of taking that innovation to scale. And it's not just the global fund, it can be other organizations too.
Right. Is there a specific example you can describe of how an organization like yours with your financing mandate has worked effectively with a startup through that hole in the wall? It's a great metaphor.
Yeah, well, one of our I think, very successful partners is an organization called Zenesis. And they created a sort of technology which allows you to effectively collate information from multiple systems. So obviously in health systems, you have multiple sources of information. You have your monitoring information on disease. You have your supply chain information of how products move in the country. You have weather information, which looks at, the risk of floods or heat waves, many other pieces of information. And in many organizations, those sources of information don't get combined into a sort of logical structure which allows people to make decisions to say there's going to be a flood or, the rainy season is here, so let's move our products faster, or we're seeing a peak of malaria, consistently in this season. Let's respond to that. So Zenesis has created this technology that sucks up all these different information sources, which is often a lot harder than it seems.
Yeah.
And puts them into sort of consistent dashboards. Also does a whole series of sort of machine learning analytics, which allows decision makers to make smarter decisions.
Wow.
And we did this sort of, almost a hole in the wall thing where we came together and said, okay, how can we support that technology, that approach even, not even just Zenesis's technology, being seen by ministries of health as really powerful? And so doing, supporting Zenesis sort of roll out in a number of countries to create these sort of case studies of saying, well, this is the power. And they did a number of things in some really interesting spaces, looking at, one of the key audiences we work on at HIV is sex workers. Because they're highly exposed, obviously. And so looking at the analysis of how do we best support people in that profession, they did a whole lot of work on COVID, integrating COVID data into systems. And so they've really scaled across a number of countries, really demonstrating the value of their technology sort of on the ground on a real time basis. So not in a sort of pilot stage, but actually real contribution to big challenges.
And I know there's a lot of analytics and AI solutions out there. What is it about Zenesis that made that partnership work? Or is it more on Zenesis's side, approaching you and expressing the interest to meet you where you wanted to meet them?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a number of things. I think one is they had a solution to what is a widespread challenge. I mean, in every Ministry of Health, almost everywhere in the world, but certainly in sort of poorer, low middle income countries, that there is this real challenge of the lack of the inability to build coherent, consolidated information systems. So there was a real problem statement there, and implementing a a fully integrated health information system is hugely expensive and complicated beyond many of these organizations.
Yeah.
So that was one. They had a solution that was really powerful. I think two is what they really demonstrated, and this is important in this sort of scaling agenda, is that they understood the context. They understood how to work in the kind of countries where the Global Fund works, in places like South Africa and Ethiopia and Rwanda. And that's really important in the sense of, you know that they will develop the technology and their approach in a way that, you know, leads you to success. And the third thing is we saw this as they demonstrated a really effective technology. They demonstrated that it could do this, and it could do it quickly and efficiently. It's not the only technology out there that does this, and our goal is never to promote a single supplier, because a single supplier will never meet all of the needs in the, you know, in the world, or even the continents that we were, even in the countries.
And technology changes, you know.
Exactly, but to really focus on saying, you know, these are the new technologies that, you know, can be really transformational in how you drive impact in sort of health systems. And so more of an example, if you like, of what needs it. And then other organizations can pick up the same kind of approaches, or they can do it slightly differently.
Yeah.
Completely fine for us.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a great example. You've talked a lot about the various different partnerships and the ways in which you've made them work. Can you talk a bit about a time when you've had to say no? Maybe, you know, a partnership that you were excited about, you wanted to make it work, they wanted to make it work, but like the factors that come together to make your job hard and to make it so that sometimes you have to say no?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say, this is obviously a good thing. Maybe not for the people we say no to, but you know, the context of innovation, I think, is that you have to expect that not everything will be successful, not everything will be relevant, and so not everything can sort of, you know, progress. One example, which is hard to talk about the names for all sorts of reasons, but we did some work in a country in Africa which looked at how do you create a framework that makes sure when you're building information systems that the systems are interoperable, you know, that they can share information, they can work together. Mm-hmm. And we did a significant piece of work in this country with the Ministry of Health to develop the sort of standards and the approaches and the frameworks of doing this better, build the capacities of people in the country to do it better. Really fantastic innovation, really fantastic output, very successful project. The challenge was what we couldn't extract was the sort of intellectual property of what made that successful. And so it was very effective, because we couldn't really define the, you know, the unique success factor, if you like, in the project, then it was very difficult to then scale that as a solution, because it means you have to do it as a sort of bespoke project everywhere you go, which makes it difficult to bring to many people.
Listeners, let me just clarify this, because I actually misunderstood it the first time I heard John say it. John's not talking about a copyright or a trademark. He's talking about replicability, that nugget of wisdom, that insight, or even that technology, which can be applied in country after country after country. In any one country, you can get pretty far just on the basis of force of will, political leadership, and plain hard work. But ultimately, for an innovation to have a truly global reach, you need that nugget, that breakthrough, that success factor, that secret sauce, whatever you want to call it. Anyways, I did end up asking John specifically about intellectual property. Did he think that licensing technology was actually a barrier to scale?
It goes in two directions in a way. And one is that exactly that, that if someone holds intellectual property very close, and so no one else can do the thing they do, that becomes a challenge, because it's, you know, it's very hard then potentially for this to go to scale. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. On the other hand, if you don't have intellectual property, i.e. you can't define your unique value proposition, then equally it's very hard to go to scale, you know, because then it just becomes we'll figure it out as we go kind of intervention. And so the truth is what you need a bit of a balance in between where you do need intellectual property. I mean, not necessarily formally in terms of patents, but you need something that is underpinning the success of your innovation that's clear. And you need to be able to sort of scale the use of that intellectual property. So it can be open sourced, it can be subcontracted or whatever else, but that space in the middle is really important to find to get to scale. I mean, if you think about the pharmaceutical sector, where obviously we buy a lot of pharmaceutical products for treatments of HIV, TB and malaria, the intellectual property is really powerful because you can't develop a pharmaceutical without intellectual property. You need a business model for it. Mm-hmm. But many of the companies we work with have out-licensed that intellectual property to allow generics manufacturers to build cheaper, you know, bigger versions of it. And so in a way, when we look at things like technology or other solutions, we have to find that similar kind of balance, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. Like, you're in it for the ways in which it can tackle HIV, TB, and malaria at scale. And so there has to be that pathway to scale, whether it be an open source approach, a licensing approach, but a way to get it at low cost to the communities that you're ultimately serving. So that map, that vision needs to exist. And if you can't find it, you can't work with that innovation or that organization. That's fascinating. John, I know you've worked your whole career. I mean, not your whole career. You've worked for many, many years in the aid sector with CIF and GAIN and Oxfam. And so you know aid. With the experience that you have now, what guidance would you give to big aid and philanthropists to effectively leverage innovation coming from the private sector?
I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it's a really important one at the moment, for sure.
We're trying to figure it out on this podcast. That's kind of why we're here.
Well, it's fantastic that, you know, that you're doing this. I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, one is, I think we know that the world in terms of some public financing is challenged on many levels, you know, whether it's African countries being able to fund their domestic, you know, their health budgets, or international high-income countries and their commitment to overseas development assistance. It's a complicated conversation. So I think from a sort of private sector side, from philanthropists and companies looking at their funding, I would say it's hugely important they do more and as much as possible. And there's massive opportunity to really drive some fantastic innovations to have huge impact. I mean, I think we've hopefully talked about examples there. And there's two spaces. I mean, one, I think we need innovation. I mean, that's what we started with. I think really central to the success of what we do, innovations in new products, innovations in deploying technologies, things like artificial intelligence, innovations in sort of new other technologies, you know, things like drones, all fantastically important. So supporting innovation is, I think, really valuable, particularly in the spaces that maybe are not about, you know, product development, but in the delivery space, because delivering it to people is the biggest challenge. So I would really say more focus on that sort of sense of last mile delivery is really critical if we're going to change the poverty issues and the health issues of the poorest. And then the third thing, and it maybe goes back to my gate, you know, door in the fence between innovation and scale. But this is the space where the biggest value is. If you think about the logic of driving impact, innovation is completely the basis of impact. You know, the new solutions are there, but the real uplift in value, same in business, same in health impact, it is in the scale. That's the 10x and the 50x of impact. So logically, if you're thinking about where you would invest and where you put your money, yes, innovation is a necessary piece, but the real space that you get if you like, your highest return on investment for impact, for driving better health for people, is in that 10x and 50x space. It's in the scaling component. It's in, you know, what they call in venture capital, that valley of death. If we don't have, I think, more financing, more investment in that, then we're missing the highly, you know, the 10 and 50x that gets us to scale. And we're also, you know, we're not providing the impetus for more innovation, because unless you have that innovation going to scale and being successful and, you know, becoming sustained, then you know, people who innovate will not continue to be in that space. So the sort of pull through of working in that scaling space is really important. So I would really say that's a fundamental space where I think often we don't get the investment profile right, because people love innovation and they love finding a new solution. But the truth is that's hugely valuable, central to our success, but not enough unless we have the 10x and 50x investment.
That is fascinating. And that's really fascinating to hear from you, John. I think on this podcast, we've talked a little bit with public donors and private investors. And on the private side, they definitely, as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on that valley of death. But to hear that validated from you, speaking as a large institutional donor, it's really compelling. I also love the first thing that you said, which I haven't heard before, which is just do more. Yeah, do more. That's my takeaway. John, you've been so generous with your time. We had just a few questions for you as part of our rapid fire segment. This is just quick questions, one or two sentences on each that we're going to run through. First one is if you wanted to offer a shout out to someone who has inspired or guided your work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, many, many people. I mean, apart from the lady in Afghanistan, who was certainly an inspiration to my work. I think one person that I've always hugely admired and has been a great sort of counsel is someone called Raj Panjabi. Many people may know he founded an organization called Last Mile Health, which developed and supported community health workers in Liberia. He's also from Liberia. He's now actually the senior director for global health security and biodefense in the US government. So has a very important role in the world of global health. But
that's
has always
changed.
Been hugely inspiring, yes. And a great friend to think about, you know, how do you connect resources and how do you connect people to really effective programs as Last Mile Health is too. So he's been a great support and someone I admire greatly in my time working in this business.
Fascinating. Next question is just for fun. Can you recommend a book, a blog, or a podcast that you've enjoyed in your personal time?
Yeah, at the moment I'm reading this really fascinating book called The Imagination Machine.
Never heard of it.
Which is by someone called Martin Reeves and another guy called Jack Fuller. And it's really fascinating. It's about how do you create the space in organizations, particularly bigger organizations, for imagination, for innovation, in essence.
Oh, wow.
And the different dimensions of what makes that successful. So, you know, in a way, recognizing that a lot of innovation, you know, one of the examples to use in the book, but one of the most oft-used examples is how Lego came to dominate the world, certainly for children.
Yeah. I got to get him on the show.
Yeah, really, really fascinating to listen to the sort of common characteristics of how you unlock imagination in order to, you know, drive it towards, you know, great new solutions and thinking. As you demonstrate, as this conversation demonstrated, it's incredibly exciting and motivating to be able to do those things. I think in so many organizations these days, we get stuck into delivering the day job and don't have that time and space and opportunity to step back and think and create. So it's hugely motivating for people, but obviously hugely value adding if you can do that. So that's a fascinating book.
Absolutely. And I love Legos. I play with them all the time. So all the more reason for me to read it. John, are there any parting words you want to share with our audience or any more information you want to pass along?
No, I mean, obviously to say thank you for having me. I think, as we talked about, the entrepreneurs that are coming up with these new ideas, I have huge admiration for the passion of the people that we meet.
Me too.
And their drive. I would say we need people to be ambitious. We need people to continue that drive that they can change the world through their solutions.
Amen.
It's hugely important. I think, as you said, maybe it's surprising to say to people to do more, but we all need to do more. You know, there are so many things happening in the world at the moment that are challenges. And as is always the case, they are the biggest challenge for the most vulnerable and the poorest in the world, you know, wherever they are. And being able to sort of get to take the passion of those entrepreneurs and, you know, the privilege I have in the Global Fund is where I can connect that to taking those things to scale and connecting those two audiences is just fantastic. So if we can do more of that together, then I think we can continue to make such a huge difference to people's lives as well.
Wow. Great words to end on, John. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you for having me.
Hope you enjoyed the show and this tiny little window into the world of how a major multilateral aid agency works with and thinks about innovation. I don't know about you, but I really liked John's guidance for donors. Do more. Just do more. If you like what you heard today, do connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter. We'll also be taking time in a future episode to discuss your questions and comments. So please send us your questions and comments to podcast@aidevolved.com. Join us again in 2 weeks when we speak with Dr. Biju Mohandas. For almost 10 years, Biju led healthcare investments in sub-Saharan Africa for IFC, the largest development finance institution, managing assets worth $3 billion to support the private sector in emerging economies. I'll see you soon.